CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 84, with Gene DeWan Jr. Innovation turns great ideas into ophthalmology practice.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest, a man who's done so much in ophthalmology. We're going to have an incredible conversation. That is Professor Gene DeWan, who I've known for, gosh, don't tell anyone, 20 years. So, Gene, everyone knows you work with Foresight Laboratories, and that's Foresight, where you've been behind a lot of the developments of new ideas, products, et cetera, in ophthalmology. Where'd all this start? Take me through your path in ophthalmology.
Well, path in ophthalmology, my father was an ophthalmologist, and I had this thought that I wanted to do something enduring or something special. One reason was, as far as I could tell, no DeWan, nobody with my last name, had done anything that was noteworthy in, if I looked in the encyclopedia, there were no DeWans that had done anything. And I thought, well, I'd like to do something. But it was a very, very unformed thought. My father, during medical school, would let me observe his surgery, and he would ask the nurse for the Castro Viejo this, or the Trotman that, or the, whatever it was. And I thought, okay, that's it. All I have to do is develop an instrument, and I can be famous forever. So it was like that. And so I started thinking, how could I make surgery better by developing a better instrument? Of course, I loved the idea of the ergonomics of needle holders, especially ophthalmic needle holders. And, do you want a round handle, or do you want locking or non-locking? And so all of that was very early in my thinking. And of course, in my training, we used what they gave us, right? We used what the professors used. And I developed a liking for a flat handle and a locking and a lot of things that probably are not the best in a way, not the most flexible, but they were what I learned with. So anyway, that's where it kind of started. And I had the opportunity, I wanted to do retina. Again, my father suggested that if I wanted to go back and practice with him in Mobile, Alabama, that I needed something special. And they needed some retina folk. And if I wanted to go back to Mobile and be successful, I'd need probably some retina training. So he said, you ought to work with this guy named Mockamer. He couldn't pronounce his name, didn't know it for sure. But he was amazed by Mockamer. He'd seen him patients, diabetic vitreous hemorrhage. And the patient would come back without a lens, but no corneal incision, no sutures in the cornea, no scars in the cornea. And he couldn't figure out how the lens got out. Of course, it was a pars plana lensectomy, and Mockamer didn't really talk about pars plana lensectomy because he was afraid that people would start doing it. And he didn't think it was the best way to take out a lens. But anyway, Dad was really impressed with that. And so he said, you should go and work with him. I didn't have a clue, how special it would be to work with this guy. You could take two people out of ophthalmology in a year. But I was able to get the fellowship, work with him. And then after a few months, he invited me to stay on as faculty at Duke. And that was the real change in my trajectory from going back and practicing with my father to kind of this academic path that I've been on for the past 40 years.
Wow. Yeah. So you were at Wilmer for your residency, Duke for your fellowship, stayed on a Duke as faculty. Then I think you were also faculty at Willmer, then faculty at USC, and now faculty at UCSF.
That's right. That's the timeline. Somebody asked me, one of the residents at UCSF asked me, did I know some retina people? And, you know, basically, I've known really some of the best retina people in the world. I mean, I knew all the folks, you know, at Willmer, like Patz and Fine and Goldberg and Finkelstein, and then later, you know, the Bresslers, and Emily Chu was a fellow, and Bob Murphy, and I, just on and on there, Ron Michaels and others there, all the fellows that were trained, and then going, you know, later to Duke, and then of course Mockamer and all the people that went through the Yasuo Tanos and Tetsuo Hidas. I mean, these were real leaders in ophthalmology in Japan and around the world. And, you know, a lot of, because of Mockamer, a lot of international, he was a big fan of the Jules Gonin Club Jules Gonin. And they all had, you know, so I was meeting all these international leaders and, you know, eventually and going to all the meetings and being invited to it. And so I was able to really connect with a very, very large variety of leaders in ophthalmology and particularly in retina. And that allowed me to, I don't know, think about a lot of different problems. And so it wasn't really that I was, so innovative in a way. I love problems. I love solving problems. But I really love to do it with people. And going to multiple places with really, really good people. And I could bring some of my experience to the table and some of my problems, you know, and have the conversation really that would result in major innovations. We didn't always know they were going to be major innovations. Like at Duke, I was operating on ROPIs. You know, there were 500 of those in the country at the time. Terrible retinal detachments. In fact, really impossible to the most severe ones could not be fixed. But, you know, the pupils were all stuck down and tiny little eyes. So that's where iris retractors were initially developed, because the orbit was so tiny and metal ones, you couldn't really make them work. So the flexible ones were required. I thought they would be used in 500 cases a year, maybe. And Mike Kobo, I don't know if you know that name, Uday, but he was the cornea guy at Duke. And he said, I think I'd like to use those for cataract. You know, I said, sure, go ahead. And, you know, obviously it's been much more useful for cataract surgery than it ever was for ROP. But still, I mean, people still use them. And it is, you know, that's, you know, more than 30, 35 years of. Then there were lots of things. So we developed small gauge instruments around that time, you know, and just lots of things.
Right. You started off with Mockamer, the father of vitrectomy. And then who would have thought that it progressed to what you end up developing later, the 25 gauge transconj vitrectomy. And now that's 23, 25, 27 gauge is all that people doing.
Right. No, and it was, you know, that transition took 10 years. People didn't, first of all, it's a little bit like cataract surgery, you know, sutureless cataract surgery.
Right.
I mean, you know, you were probably at the forefront of that, I'm sure. And it just, you know, people had to learn how to make the wounds better, had to learn how to make them smaller, had to learn. Right. You know, same for 25 gauge. If you did it right, it was great, you know, and patient recovery was great, and OR times went way down, and it was all wonderful. But if you did it wrong, you'd get a little bit of leak, you'd get hypotony. You know, they would blame the tool rather than
the technique,
the guy holding the tool.
Right.
Yeah.
It was interesting when you came out with 25 gauge vitrectomy. When it first came out, I was actually at the beginning of my academic career as a little assistant professor there at a county hospital here in LA. And I worked with my peds guy, and I said, you know, I have an idea. Would you do a case? We have a congenital cataract coming up in this little baby. We should do a 25 gauge vitrectomy. So still using your 25 gauge instruments to make two tiny limbal incisions and do, from the anterior approach, a baby lensectomy. And it was amazing. And we published it right away, and that's just how it's done now. So even your idea of the vitrectomy instruments were applicable to congenital cataracts.
Once you start seeing the possibilities, you know, it just builds. And of course, the instruments get better, and like the opportunities for using those instruments get better, like you said, for lensectomy. Particularly infant or kid lensectomy, it was able possible. That's really gratifying for me.
What's interesting too is that your thinking is not just retina. Like I like cataract. I can barely spell retina, but you're involved in so many projects in the whole eye. Some of your former companies like Transcend Medical. You've done that. So you've been in basically anterior segment surgery, glaucoma surgery, retina surgery, everything.
I don't care. I don't really care. Once I start to see a problem, like you said, for glaucoma. So Transcend was a really, it's a really good story.
Tell me.
Okay. So my purpose in Transcend was not to come up with a minimally invasive adjunct to cataract surgery. That was not my purpose. My purpose was what will work for glaucoma patients around the world, Africa, India, China, wherever. And so I said, well, there are not enough ophthalmologists. So it has to be something super simple, something that anybody can do. And it has to be done under topical. It has to be straight topical, not retrobulbar, nothing, no real cutting. It certainly should be combined with cataract surgery. It's just because people that are having glaucoma, you shouldn't do a glaucoma procedure and come back and do cataract, or do cataract and not do a glaucoma procedure and do one later. It's just you need to do that at the same time. So fine to combine with. I love the thing, that cataract surgery is really good glaucoma surgery too.
Sure.
And so topical, anybody can do, needle stick, internal drainage. There shouldn't be a blemb. There should not be the chance of infection late, because you can't follow up these patients. If they get a red eye, you don't want to get an infection.
Sure.
So internal drainage, topical, and could be combined with cataract surgery. And could be done with a loop, didn't need a microscope. So those were the constraints in my mind. And so that's what Transcend is. It's just a needle stick, 25 gauge, goes right in. You just push it into the angle. There's a natural cleavage point at the scleral spur into the suprachoroidal space. And that's the way we started. And it worked. I knew that cyclodialysis would work.
Sure.
I mean, it wasn't like there was, you know, like mechanistically, I knew it would work. I was afraid that it would work too good.
Right.
And that you'd have hypotony. So the making a little control, basically a controlled cyclodialysis, a stented cyclodialysis. And so that was I've forgotten how long that company went, but it was 7, 8, 9 years, over $100 million in it. And it gets approved. We show, at the time, Glaukos had a 1-year study, and we had to have a 2-year study because you remember the first iteration of Glaukos, they lost efficacy in the second year. So the FDA made us take 2 years. And then, so we show that it worked after 2 years. And then Novartis buys us. A year after they buy us, that's now 5 years, they start noticing that the ones that were sticking out a little bit started touching the cornea, and they were having endothelial cell loss around that device. And they voluntarily took it off the market, and it surprised the FDA. And the FDA did a class one recall and took it off the market and never made it back. As far as I know, and I don't know how many of these you did, very, very, very few patients lost vision from, right. Very few, 0.1%, you know, some really low number. And so it was a overreaction to something that, you know, should be out there. There are plenty of people losing vision every day from glaucoma. So right. That one kind of hurt me. I mean, financially some, but the real thing was it hurt the people that don't have other options around the world.
Right.
Most of the other ones take very trained surgeons in combination with cataract often. So it's just, that's the story on that. And a lot of people have tried to reintroduce the thought again. Sure. and solve the problem of corneal touch, which seems to be totally solvable in my book.
Right.
But it's just, you know, how do you get investment and things around that? So anyway, that's a war story of success and failure, you know. I've had plenty of both.
Oh, I said, so you've come up with so many different ideas, so many project companies, so many patents in ophthalmology. So it's okay that some of your ideas will really fly and some not so much. And so
No. It is a numbers game in that sense. As an investor, it's a numbers game. But as somebody, when you spend 10 years on a project, it's like children. You know, it's not a numbers game. No matter how many children you got,
you still love them all.
You got to love them all. You care completely. You're totally focused. And so if you're in a big company, and that's the difference between a big company and a small company.
Okay.
Big companies they talk about failing fast. You've heard this a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, identify a project, and if it's not going well, you kill that project. And you see that in big companies, they'll kill a project. If you're a small company, I mean, it's like, you know, you only got one boat. You're not going to abandon the boat. That's all you got, you know. So you got to make it work. And small companies are much better at making things work because you have to.
Right.
You really have to. And I think small companies are just, you know, I don't know, twice as good at making something work as a large company of a new technology, because you don't really have a choice. You know, you really have to.
It's sink or swim.
I love sink or swim. And one of the best stories I know is the difference of success of a company started by our business, started by an immigrant versus started by a native-born American. A native-born American has a 25% chance of success when they start a business, you know, wherever it is.
Sure.
If you're an immigrant, you have a 50% chance of success.
Wow.
It's just like, what are you going to do if it's not successful? You know, and I love that. I love it. You know, that you, if you have to make something work, you can't.
Yeah. My dad used to say before he passed away, he said, if you ever have a chance to bet on yourself, just bet the farm.
There you go. It's really, that's a really important thing of people that know and have that ability. Of course you have it. And betting on yourself is the most sure thing you can do. You're it's right. A really, you understand your weaknesses better than other people. Right. You understand your strengths better than other people. You learn, right. And you're not subject to, you know, I don't know, things that are falsely put on you for right. whatever reason. I mean, I'm not a particularly good follower.
Sure.
And that's, you know, so that's a good and bad thing. But you know, so it's good if you're an innovator, but it's not good. I don't think I would be really good at a big company. I mean, I would be, unless I really was at the very, very top, then I'd be wonderful.
No, these are all important things. So a lot of our podcast listeners are very on the younger side, let's say in the 30s and 40s. And you've always been very good at inspiring and kind of motivating that next generation of ophthalmologists. So what advice would you give? Let's say you've got a youngish, someone in the 30-year-old ophthalmologist, he or she recently finished training, now is in practice, and has just some really great idea that they're passionate about. How do you proceed?
You know, so first of all, it is so important that the people who want to make the world a better place do it. They it's just, there was an Apple commercial, you know, the people that are crazy enough to want to change the world are the ones that do.
All right.
You know, so to me, of course, not everybody wants to do that, and not everybody needs to do that. Doctors, for the most part, I make this joke, but it's a true joke. We're like car mechanics. We're all Chevrolets. There's no difference. You know, we're just that's what we are. And if you go to a car mechanic and you say, man, and he says, you know, look, I've never tried it before, but I really think we could put, you know, gasoline in the battery and it would be a lot better. You go, no, just keep it exactly like we want, like you've done. I don't need any innovation in my car maintenance. But we have to have these innovators, and they have to be in good places, and they have to be, do it right, you know, but if you want to do those things, like you've done it, like figuring out how to take out a lens in an infant in a better way, I really think that that's so important, and it needs to be encouraged. And a lot of people ask me, okay, how do you do it? What's the first step? How do I go? Do I need to get a patent first? Or what do I need to do? I think what I advise people is talk to your friends first. Talk to somebody who, you know, who understands that field that you're talking about, whether it's cataract surgery or retinal surgery or whatever it is. Talk to them, ask them if your new idea is the right idea. You will have, it's probably not the right idea, right? It's probably, the first idea is the chances are, almost no chance, that it's the best idea. So the ideas develop, and they develop in talking to people. And you think about it, and you think about it. And for Irish Retractors, we've thought about a lot of things. I mean, it was a problem. It took us 4 or 5 years. We started with metal ones. We started with kind of tacks. We, it was just a lot internal, external, lots of different things. 25 gauge, same, making smaller and smaller instruments, how to get it to cut right. You know, so the problem kind of was clear, but the solution was not. So you just kind of keep going at it. Sometimes we have a solution to a problem that's not really so interesting. So again, somebody with real experience, sage advice, saying, no, I don't think I would worry about figuring out new dyes for contact lenses. Okay. Somebody else can work on that and work on things that, whatever it is. I tell you, the right thing to work on is myopia progression or whatever the bigger problem is. And then as long as you are excited about solving the problem, identifying the right problem and solving that problem will get a lot more traction. You can, get people behind you, can work with you, can think through it. So that's, and the other thing is work with people that are known innovators. I mean, I don't know, Uday, you have a broader view of innovation in ophthalmology through this and other ways. What do you think? I mean, I think a lot of people are not so excited about innovation. There's still plenty of people that are, but I don't know how they, or if they're willing to take it to the next step. Maybe you can help me there.
Yeah, I think you got a great point there, that in ophthalmology, it keeps evolving. Every once in a while, there's something revolutionary, but there's constant evolution throughout our field. And like, the way I do surgery now is not the way I did it 10 years in the past. And it's not the way I'm going to do it 10 years in the future. So I've got it. The onus is on me to kind of keep up with the changes, but also hopefully to help innovate some of those changes. And so other point you had was fantastic, which is your initial idea is good, but the chance of you nailing it right off the bat is pretty low. So you have to discuss it with friends, colleagues, evolve that idea, be tenacious, okay to fail on a little thing just to get back on track. Because I always think every success or every failure, they're on the same path of my ultimate journey. So a failure is okay. It's still the same path. And I think being tenacious like that, it just takes time. And I've often underestimated the amount of time it takes and the amount of work it takes to achieve an idea.
Oh yeah, and I'm running out of time. It's money's not the problem; time is the problem. And right. I think what you're saying, just to ask, where's cataract surgery going? Is it robotics? I personally have some questions of how good robotics can be, and do we need it, and are there technologies that you think that in 10 years we're going to have, that we're not going to need surgeons to do cataract surgery? I don't know. How do you see it?
Well, I think the robotic cataract surgery is already in development, both kind of telesurgery or remote surgery, or where you're not necessarily in the room next to the patient, but also more importantly, more automated parts of the procedure. If you just take a step back and look at something like keratorefractive surgery, we went from 100% manual, which would be like radial keratotomy in the 1980s and 90s, to now, if I look at what I just did this week for LASIK, I line up the patient under the femto, it makes the flap. What do I actually do there, right? Then I pivot to the next laser, I lift the flap, which certainly you can teach a robot to do. The Exmer does an ablation at 400 or 500 hertz, tracking the eye. I put the flap down. So isn't it already 90% robotic? And it's not that much of a leap to think it's going to go a little bit more. Now, if you look at the world's most common surgery, the U.S.'s most common surgery, cataract surgery, I think for 90% plus of our cases, which are routine cases, robotic assisted will just make us better. So you still need a surgeon. I flew, you know, recently I had a pilot who had autopilot, but I still needed the pilot. But I think it made the pilot a little bit safer to have these extra controls on board. And if we look at robotic surgery, I'm involved in a company now called Horizon Surgical here in Los Angeles. So there's my disclosure. But in this company, just think, well, what's the fastest? What's human reaction time? My reaction time is 200 milliseconds. If you're an F1 race car driver, maybe your reaction time is 100 milliseconds. But can't you have a robot achieve a 1 or 2 millisecond reaction time? That's so much better than even an F1 race car driver. Or even data. I look through an operating microscope at about 30 frames a second. Like if I watch TV or a movie, they show it to me 25, 30 frames a second. It looks fluid to me. So it means the most I can data capture from my brain visually is 30 frames a second. Well, a robot could not only get the visual at 1,000 frames a second if you wanted, but it also can couple that with an OCT real-time imaging and get the data together, the visual and the OCT. So it could see the posterior capsule better than I can see it.
So safety or efficacy? I mean, safety or are you going to... Is this going to cut cost and increase safety, or is it going to increase cost and increase safety? You know, so I'm trying to think. You know, where does that fit? Wouldn't something like, let's just say you could inject something into the AC, and you put a 25, 27 gauge instrument and aspirate the lens very similar to the way you did to those kids.
That could be the next step too.
Would that be better than robotic surgery?
Well, the catch there is in the babies, when you're operating on a 1 month old infant, you're leaving them aphakic to get contact lenses for the first year or two, and then finally get an IOL. But for those little tiny eyes, to have two incisions of, let's say, less than a millimeter, that's a benefit, because you don't have to put an IOL in. And a human, and a big adult, if I'm doing a 2 1-millimeter incisions, we saw this with, in cataract surgery, 15 years ago, the biaxial or the infused phaco chopper and then the bare needle in one hand, we had sub-1-millimeter incisions for a cataract surgery, but then you got to put an IOL in somehow. And then we realized smaller is not always better. So if I want to do like a complex retina case, bad diabetic, maybe I'm better off doing 23 gauge instead of 27 gauge. Is the lack of flow from 27 worth having a slightly smaller incision? Maybe not.
Right, for sure. Right. So I mean, I think they're also. You know, I try to think about what are the problems of the future, which ones do I want to solve? You know, of course, you know, accommodation, you know, I'm working on an accommodating lens.
Right.
That's an exciting one. You know, we're zooming into that. Of course, others in the field are too. It's really exciting to me. It's a huge problem. If we fix that, then we can, I can go to the beach, you know, and relax a little bit. Glaucoma seems to be a real problem that we haven't solved, you know,
right.
Medically, I think we can do better. AMD, but you know, refractive error, we don't have a really good, I understand that refractive error is the number one cause of blindness around the world.
Right.
And if you had a means of quickly and safely causing, you know, fixing refractive error in a non-destructive way, one that you could adjust as the patient got older or things, that would be a wonderful focus. You know, in other words, what would I tell kids, young doctors, take on one of these real big problems, mm-hmm. refractive error. Just go for it. If I, you know, if you, you know, go back 30 years or whenever you started 25 years ago, it's been at least 25 years that I've known you. So I know you've been going,
right.
you know, 30 years. You go 30 years and, you know, take on a huge problem like refractive error. And if you spent 30 years figuring out how do I make a reversible, adjustable, repeatable adjustment for refractive error that is push button and nobody else, you could have figured it out, don't you think? For if you spent 30 years on that problem.
I don't know. I may have spent 30 years just kind of treading water and not going anywhere.
I don't know. I think if you really want to do something, you know, I look at Elon Musk, you know, I'm so impressed that he looks at a problem and he says, okay, I'll do it. You know, whatever it is, an electric car. I mean, he was an early investor, maybe a founding investor, and, you know, the SpaceX, you know, the whole, you know, satellite communication, all of those things are so amazing to me that you just think about it and you can do it. And I think we should be bold like that. Doctors are not supposed to be really bold. We're not trained to be bold. We're trained to be not bold. And we're trained to be good, careful, consistent, you know, data driven. But, you know, there's some people out there that need to create the data and, you know, create True. The new things. And you know, so I'd like for us to be, that's one of the things I would really like to leave our field with, this sense that, you know, you can go and you can really change the world.
Yeah, you absolutely can. In fact, when I started making the Counter Coach videos, my idea, which to my own ears sounded stupid when I first said it, was about 7-8 years ago. I said, you know, I want to change the way cataract surgery is kind of taught and learned worldwide. And I want to do that by making a new video every day. And so for the last 2,300, 2,400 days, I've made a new video every day. And I haven't missed a day yet.
Wow.
And so, wow. Well, it's either a sign of passion or a sign of crazy, or maybe both.
Well, it's a little. I think you need to have a little bit of both. I mean, in the sense, it's of course it's not crazy, but it's what is the motivation to not miss a day? It's something internal, and you can say, well, you know, not everybody has that, but it's what a wonderful passion. You know, what you really want to do is make that people have access to fresh thinking every day.
Right. Just 5 minutes a day. So it was the idea behind it. And honestly, it's another example of me underestimating the amount of work a project's going to require. I had no idea it's this much work, but it's also something where I learn, oh my gosh, more than I teach. I learned so much by studying other people's videos. 30 to 50 videos are sent to me a week. I watch all of them and I select like 4, 5, 6, 7 of them for the week. And you edit them and feature them and I learned from them. And I mean, I taught myself how to do DMEC corneal transplantation surgery by watching videos of others. And then I learned to do it. And then when I was still teaching residents, which I retired from 2 years ago, but I would teach the residents how to do it. I learned from watching video.
I you know, I love that. One of the things, one of my mantras in vitreoretinal surgery is there's always a better way. There's always a better way. And of course, vitreoretinal fellows and residents watching vitreoretinal surgery, is certainly initially they don't get to do that much. That's kind of a late part of the process. But I say, you watch me and you see me suffering, you know, or struggling, and you see what my problem is. I don't see what my problem is. I'm just trying to get to the edge of the pool, and so you see what my problem is, and you can begin to solve that problem. And if you don't, if you're not a very good fellow, you need to see my problems and tell me how to solve them, and then I'll think you're a good fellow. And what you're doing is you're looking at that and you're able to integrate it and condense it with your knowledge and push that forward. That's amazing.
Right. In fact, that was my favorite thing for a resident. I'd say, what I teach you is not like set in stone. If I'm teaching you something and you think of a better way, show me. Say something.
Yeah. Absolutely. I push it a little harder. And if you don't, you're not a very good one.
Yeah, no, I think it's how a lot of these innovations kind of start here. Now, I got to ask you about on the retina side, are we going to get away from, every month injections now? I mean, now we're at the point we're doing, 10, 15 million injections in the U.S. a year. It's a huge burden. Can we get to something, a longer-term solution?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I worked on a while back that, again, had an off-on process was what they called the PDS, the port delivery system for Lucentis. Is a little reservoir that you put in the eye and you can refill it. And there were five presentations at the Retina Society, and mostly related to diabetic retinopathy, but it showed that much better than multiple injections, that this controls, you have one injection lasting 9 months, and it could probably go longer. Mm-hmm. And so the problem kind of has been solved. It hadn't been solved perfectly because it's a new surgical technique. If you put this thing into the eye, the conj can erode, you can get an endophthalmitis, more than with a regular injection, and you can get hemorrhage from the device. Sure. All of those things, and I think about cataract surgery, how it's developed, we figure out how to solve all of the problems. We have to see the problem. We have to work on the world solves these problems. Right. And it's not like you start with the problem solved. You don't. You solve the problems over time, and especially with surgical technique. Now the surgical technique has gotten much better. The early device, I don't know, you might not know, this little tiny device that holds 25 microliters, there was a little septum that you injected through, and that septum came dislodged. It was overmolded, so it didn't leak. Mm-hmm. But they had to pull it out and for 2 years learn how to put that septum so it wouldn't fall. So I do think that that's coming. Also, I think they're better, longer-acting drugs. They have drugs now that last 3 months, even longer potentially. And so that's helped a lot. I think ultimately just getting drugs to the back of the eye, Lucentis is a great drug. It's our penicillin, but they're better drugs coming all the time. Sure. There was iBio, Tony Adamus's company that got bought by Merck, has a WNT inhibitor that is very promising. So I think these new drugs, whatever they are, neuroprotection is going to need very sustained delivery as well. The GA drugs that you have to inject every month or two, need this kind of delivery, this very sustained delivery. And it's a big area for retina. And so I do think that that's coming. Also, the gene therapies are another way of getting proteins to the eye for a long period of time. I personally like that. And also like the delivery. I really, if you just need the drug, just delivering the drug by itself seems to be a really good idea.
Right. So, how come you couldn't like deliver a drug in a gel matrix that would slowly dissolve and then slowly release the drug over time?
Yeah, no, that's one of the ways that it's being delivered now. There's a company called Ocular Therapeutics that is doing just that. Has a what they call a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, which is a cancer drug that attacks the same VEGF targets and anti-VEGF targets, and it's in this cross-linked matrices that can maybe last 6 months or potentially longer. So it's coming, and you know, glaucoma drugs the same, and all of these drug deliveries, the drug usually goes out faster than the delivery system.
Mm.
So it's releasing the drug, and then it's kind of like you have some overhang from the residual delivery system, but it doesn't go away quite as fast. It's kind of like oxygen canisters at the top of Everest or something. You know,
right.
What do you do with them? You're not going to carry them down. But so it's there's lots of opportunity there too. Yeah. But we're not going to, for sure, we're not going to be doing it monthly. And right now, you know, for retina doctors, you remember, you know, retina doctors when they were just taking care of bad PVR, bad diabetics,
right.
Trauma, you know, now we are basically medical ophthalmologists. You know, we're doing these injections, and there are a lot of retina people that really focus on that part of the practice, and you know, it's rewarding financially, and also the patients are well served with that. But it's a totally different type of practice than when we started.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, a lot of these retina specialists would do better financially spending the day in the clinic as opposed to spending the day in the operating room.
Absolutely. The big difference. It's amazing, actually, how big a difference that is.
Now, tell me what's coming for the accommodating lens. So I used to not believe in presbyopia until it happened to me. Wait a minute. Now, luckily, I have one saving grace, which is right here. I'm a -2 spherical. So that's become a blessing in my life now that I'm presbyopic. But tell me, how does your accommodating IOL work?
Well, the accommodating IOL has been a really fun project. The biggest, I was trained, and I don't know, maybe you too, with this idea that the reason you got presbyopia was because the ciliary body kind of ran out of steam. There was not enough muscular, neural connections to make that work. That's not true, it turns out. I mean, just like the iris works your whole life, it doesn't work quite as well as when you're 10 as when you're 70, but it still works.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentally, it still works. And so the assumption that you can interact with the ciliary body either by a traditional mechanism, like putting a lens inside the bag and having that bag work in a traditional way that it, you know, it moves back and forth like the natural lens does, and that's been the way most people have looked at it. Power vision was like that, and some of the others. I personally like interacting directly with the ciliary body. So if the ciliary body, if the ciliary body is working, put a little piston right next to the ciliary processes. And when they contract or when they move in during accommodation, they'll push on a little, basically like a piston, we call them force transfer arms, and move fluid to the center and cause a change in the shape of the center of the lens. And that was the idea. So it's not dependent on the capsule, which was we thought was important. The sizing is fixed, you know, so you can measure it very precisely. You don't have to, the sizing of a capsule is variable. It's like, you know, it changes about 50% depending on things that are not totally clear to me. But the sizing of the ciliary processes in particular is pretty well defined. You can define it with ultrasound, and you know, people are getting so they can understand it with OCT. And so that's where we started. And we've done like 6 or 7 iterations of that concept. And we're getting really close. The last clinical trial we did had 20/20 uncorrected across the full range from distance to near.
Wow.
20/20 uncorrected across that range. And we compared it with a Acrosoft lens monofocal, and we were better at distance uncorrected than the monofocal.
Wow.
How's it possible that we could be, you know, we're not optically better, probably in that way. We're not optically better. We're good. We're really good, but not as good as a monofocal lens. And but it's because it accommodates. If you're off a little bit, it'll fix itself, you know, a little bit like being a kid, you know, if you're off a little bit, you can fix it. I'm hyperopic, which is worse for me from a presbyopia standpoint. But I'm real happy with that. We'll see, you know, that's a really hard project because you got to nail it. I mean, right. The bar is so high. Everybody doesn't like presbyopia, but nobody likes bad distance vision.
Right.
I mean, so it's we talk a lot about presbyopia, but it's really what we care the most about is good overall vision, and we can deal with near vision. So the bar is very, very high, and you know, we hope that we're up to it. I'm excited about that project.
Yeah, it'd solve a lot of issues. So if you're able to have a lens of true accommodation, it's almost like doing LASIK on a 23-year-old. So if you get a 23-year-old myope, you obviously want to make them plano, but if they end up plus a quarter or plus a half, they're still thrilled because they've got 10 diopters of accommodation.
You're right.
So you solve the issue with IOL calculations, because if you have a lens that gives 3, 4, 5 diopters of accommodation, and if someone ends up plus a quarter, plus a half, they're still thrilled. They got amazing distance vision.
Absolutely. Maybe even a little better. You know, I'm very excited about that project. I'm very hopeful that we get it so that it will be for everybody. You know, that would be a real kick. And, you know, retina guys, you know, they shouldn't do that. They shouldn't be messing around over there.
Well, like you said, you enjoy the whole eye.
Yeah.
And also you said something important. You said now you've gone through 6 or 7 iterations. So another example of, you don't nail it right off the bat. You've got to be persistent and evolve it.
You don't, it's always, you're very close. You're very close. You know, you solve one problem. Sometimes you create another, but usually you just get closer and closer, and the bar just gets higher and higher. You know, we showed that we had accommodation, but then we showed that we didn't, you know, that our near vision wasn't good enough or not enough accommodation. And how do you prove you have accommodation? And what does the FDA want? And what does the world want? And then, you know, so just, and what do companies want? You know, how good do we have to be before, you know, and that bar is just getting higher and higher, and where we thought we were walking on water, you know, to get any accommodation. Now we know that unless you're perfect, it's not good enough.
Right. Well, especially because how we'll see in the future is you get someone who's 50 years or older, you're not going to do any cataract surgery. You're going to do a lenticular base, restore their accommodation, fix their distance vision, all the same sitting.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm looking at it like I want it to get good enough that I want it. I'm getting close that I want this particular lens. I'm not quite there. I'm going to let this next iteration, but I really like to have full range of vision again. I would really like that.
I think we're going to get there. I think with this young generation, the new generation of ophthalmologists, they're brighter and more innovative than ever. The amazing thing I've seen in the new generation is they can learn from others much faster than I ever could. I would have to watch OSHA's videotapes 25 years ago to learn a new technique on VHS tape. And now anyone can watch it on their phone in high definition, anywhere on the planet. It's amazing.
Where do you get most of your videos from? Where do they send them to you from? I mean, are you sending them from around the world, I'm sure, or
yeah, so it's
Europe, US?
Yeah, Cataract Coach has grown a tremendous amount. It's more than the total views is more than 1 million a month. So it's 35,000-40,000 views in a day. I've learned to master the media here for the social stuff. So it posts automatically every day at 2 a.m. California time, which is 5 a.m. East Coast, because my number one market's America, US, and I want the East Coast doctor to have the video in the morning when they have their coffee before they go to work. And so it goes to cataractcoach.com, YouTube, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, all at the same time, all automated every morning at 2 a.m. I'm asleep when they post. And then from them there, on the cataractcoach.com website, there's actually a link, like, doctor, you can submit your video here. And I don't use all of them, but I get 30 to 50 videos sent to me a week from all over the world. We're in almost every country. My number one country is US, number two is India, number three is Brazil. But now there are close to 100,000 subscribers to the videos. So it's just a crazy number now. I just can't even imagine.
Where's the innovation? It seems to me that the innovation is going places like India and Brazil. In other, there's more desire to show new things in those countries.
Yeah,
I think
it's coming from every corner of the globe. And that's the neat part here, is now that it's all so easily connected, the world, I can feature a video from a surgeon from any country if you have something innovative, and then I immediately get peer review. So if I feature a video, let's say I had a video recently where there was a mystery. I didn't know what the answer was. So I post it. Well, I've got 5,000 surgeons watched it in the first day and left 100 comments to give me some insight. So it's amazing to have that ability to kind of peer review of anything instantly.
Wow. No, it's very powerful. I guess, how do larger companies, if I'm an Alcon or whatever, and I want somebody to review new things, how do they click into that? How do they get, that feedback? Or they probably don't want it publicly. I don't know. But it seems like it would be a powerful thing to get feedback and respond to it like that.
Right. So we have ability for companies to do promoted things with us or sponsored things with us, where we can send it out to, let's say, our top 5,000 viewers, the most consistent viewers, and something just to them, and then you can get their input. And so it's neat to be able to crowdsource this or to get a new idea across. The company now presents us with an idea of a new innovative instrument. So we'll do a sponsored video for them and just get the word out and just see what the public reaction is. Here's something new or innovative. Yeah. What do you think? And so it's every product lives on its own merit.
Absolutely.
But other benefit has been, there's so many countries where the surgical residency and fellowship training is not enough. And right. So this kind of democratized it so that everyone on the planet can see the same videos. I even evolved it further. There's a free cataract coach book. It's actually a PDF file you can download from anywhere, watch, look, read it on your phone. There's a free 25-part curriculum series of how to learn FACO. And that's also freely available. And so this year I actually was just in Egypt and then in Dubai and in India. I've done 21 countries this year to lecture. So I've barely been home.
Whoa.
Right. Everywhere Whoa. I go, the number of thanks I get from young ophthalmologists is, you know, I've learned so much from your channel. That's where I get the majority of my surgical education. It blows my mind.
That's so wonderful, Uday. That's great. Yeah. I mean, it's important and it's really, really great.
And what
I was in a.
Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that a long time ago, I was doing a procedure they called retinal translocation. You might remember some of that for AMD. And they did live surgery. The ASRS did live surgery. So I was doing this procedure at Hopkins, and they showed it around the world, same time. Kirk Pacco organized this. And so I was doing, and it was a tricky surgery, and, you know, so it was a little bit of drama. But it was so wonderful to get requests during the surgery from all over the world, from Japan, from India, from Africa. And this was in Baltimore, and then we got a request from Baltimore as well. And just, it was, I do think that same time learning, you know, that everybody is kind of in the same bucket at the same time coming is a wonderful way of, spreading the knowledge. And so congratulations to you for something that's really impactful and good.
Oh, thank you. It's same with our podcast. The purpose behind the podcast is to give our young viewers or all listeners some insight into like this, where we can talk about how to innovate in ophthalmology. What do you do if you have an idea? What's kind of the process? So it's just to motivate the young generation and teach them the stuff you don't learn in residency or fellowship.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one area that I'm also getting interested in is otology. There's not a single drug for hearing loss. The ear and the eye are very, very similar. I mean, they have hair cells and you have photoreceptors and you have auditory ganglion cells and retinal ganglion cells and you have a stria vascularis and a choroid. I mean, there are all these similarities. But despite all the drugs we have in ophthalmology and retina, we don't have anything for hearing loss. Yeah. And so minimally invasive approaches to have sustained delivery to, you know, some it's deep in the skull. But it's so apparent to me that there's so much opportunity. 40 million people with hearing, you know, so what would I do? Take a big problem like hearing loss,
mm-hmm.
you know, figure out some way and make people better, and it'll be a big deal.
Right.
Or at least fun trying.
Well, I think that's what you like is the challenge. You like all these challenges. You like the process of problem solving and kind of taking the challenge and get an idea, birth it, evolve it, and bring it to market. I read a quote about you. One of your friends, I said, the quote I liked about you is you were interviewed. You said, I just want to help patients. So the motivation behind all your projects is you just want to help patients.
I do. I mean, deeply. It's absolutely true. And it's, I have a very, 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 you know, it started with making an instrument, but it's also really deep in my nature to, you know, that's why I like being a doctor, you know, and I'm frustrated that we're not better and happy to try to work to make people better. It is, I took a test, psychological evaluation test at some point, and people in pain, I really don't like people suffering. This is, I have an abnormally sensitive response to people suffering, they said. Well, maybe it's true.
You've done amazing things. The projects you've worked on ophthalmology alone have impacted millions of lives. That's amazing. Amazing. So, neat stuff. Well, Gene, I want to tell you, thank you again for doing this podcast. Always a pleasure. You've been a mentor to me for so many years. I'm fortunate to know you for so long. And I think you're a mentor to the whole next generation. And again, thank you for doing our podcast. And I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new podcast every single Sunday. And of course, there's still a new Cataract Coach video every day. So until next time, we'll check you later.